This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The leaked opinion from the Supreme Court on the Mississippi abortion case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, seems to promise a true transformation in this country. Assuming the final opinion by Justice Alito gets majority support, and it, let's face it, it very likely will, we'll see the end of federal reproductive choice in America. And that will change the country. In many red states, abortion bans will take effect immediately. But this would also have very real effects in blue states, from New York to California. In fact, Mitch McConnell has already talked about a complete nationwide ban. I'm joined now by three New Yorker writers who have been considering where all this is going: Margaret Talbot, Peter Slevin, and Gia Tolentino. We'll start with Margaret Talbot, who's reported on the Supreme Court. She's written about justices including Antonin Scalia, Elena Kagan, and most recently, the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett.
You know, I think we're so used to these confirmation hearings where people are asked and, you know, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski get some sort of promise from Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett, or wishfully think that they have heard them say, well, this is settled law, so it's, you know, stare decisis, respect for precedents, we're not going to overturn this.
Let's stop there. But were they lying in their confirmation hearings?
You know, if you look at what they actually say, I don't think they were actually lying. I think they were obfuscating. I think they were, they say things like, it's settled law. Well, that's just a statement of fact. It was settled law. They don't say, it's settled law in a decision that I believe in. In the case of Amy Coney Barrett, though, there was a really, you know, very, very explicit track record of opinions that she'd expressed outside the court. I mean, she had signed a two-page ad that appeared in the South Bend newspaper when she was a professor at Notre Dame in 2006, saying, you know, that abortion was barbaric, that Roe had to be overturned. She was a member of the campus faculty Right to Life group. So, I mean, you know, I think it's one thing for somebody to say, I don't think this was a well-decided legal precedent. It's another thing for them to say abortion is barbaric. Then I think it just beggars, you know, common sense to think that when you're presented with a chance to overturn something you think is barbaric, you think is, you know, murder, that you won't do it.
Assuming that Roe is overturned, and I think that's where we are in our journey of assumptions, what's the next step for the conservative legal establishment?
Yeah, well, I think they have, you know, a pretty big agenda, and you see the sort of legislative form of it at work in the bills in Florida to prevent discussion of gay issues in classrooms, in, you know, the anti-trans bills, in the attacks in some cases on birth control. The Idaho state legislature said that it was going to open hearings on the morning after pill. But because of the makeup of the court now, I think some matters that would have been thought truly settled become up for debate or up for consideration again. I mean, same-sex marriage decisions, same-sex intimacy, even perhaps contraception, are potentially on the table again. You know, a lot of people thought we wouldn't get this far with Roe. So I wouldn't, you know, completely rule it out.
Is there a world in which abortion becomes banned throughout the United States. There's a lot of talk now about people traveling from, say, Mississippi to Illinois, if they can afford it, and they can, to get an abortion. But is there a world of a national ban?
Again, I think it's not completely off the table. I mean, I think that that is the goal of this anti-abortion movement, which has been remarkably passionate and successful and determined, and they would like to have a national ban on abortion. And you're right that, you know, right now we have a profound division. Probably, you know, the prediction is 26 states, mostly in the South and Midwest, will ban abortion completely after this decision goes into effect. And people will try and travel to other states where abortion is still legal, and they will try and get medication, abortion pills sent to them through the mail. But a lot of states now, anti-abortion states, are trying to criminalize travel for abortion or receiving of pills in the mail. I mean, I would think maybe a realistic scenario would be many states would keep it legal, but the states where it's illegal would try their best to make it very difficult to travel to get an abortion.
Now, with the restrictions already in place in Texas and other states, people seeking abortions have already been traveling very long distances to obtain medical care. Peter Slevin is based in Chicago, and he's been watching all of this unfold. Peter, you just published a piece about how abortion providers in various states are preparing for what we're now calling the post-Roe world. You're based in Chicago. You spoke to providers in various states near you. To get a sense of where we are now, how easy is it to get an abortion in the Midwest?
It depends on which part of the Midwest. Illinois has made itself into a safe haven for abortion through legislation. There's no waiting period. Medicaid will pay for an abortion. The Democratic legislature and Governor J.B. Pritzker, also a Democrat, got rid of the parental notification law. But it is a very different picture in the rest of the Midwest, where abortion access is already extremely difficult without the Supreme Court weighing in on the Dobbs case.
Now, in Chicago, what kind of demand are abortion providers seeing? What are they predicting if Roe falls? Will there be a huge influx to places like Chicago?
It's been interesting to see already what the influx is from out of state. Everyone remembers what happened with SB8 in Texas, which banned abortions after 6 weeks. Chicago saw its first Texas patient within just a couple of days after SB8 went into effect. Already in recent years, the numbers of out-of-state patients have been growing really quite dramatically. Planned Parenthood of Illinois, which has been preparing for this for quite some time, thinks that in the first year after Roe is overturned, if that's what the Supreme Court does, the numbers of out-of-state patients may grow by 20,000 or more.
Now, we've been hearing a lot about medication abortion, a combination of common drugs that could be prescribed remotely. You talked in your piece with a provider in Minnesota who's been working on this. Tell me about her practice.
It's quite intriguing what's going on with medication abortion. According to the Guttmacher Institute, in 2020, 54% of abortions in this country were done through the two-pill regimen.
And now these two pills are, to just be specific,
there's mifepristone, which stops progesterone, which stops a pregnancy from growing, and then misoprostol, which creates contractions. These pills are legal in 60 countries. The FDA has said they are safe and effective. The OBGYN community in this country says the same. And more patients are turning to these pills, which they can get sometimes through telemedicine, sometimes over the web.
And what will happen to those medications in a post-Roe world?
Republicans in a number of states are racing to try to outlaw medication abortions. They're doing this through restrictions that require a woman to see a doctor in South Dakota more than once, with a waiting period and so on. Some states are banning telemedicine appointments, which are, again, deemed by the medical community to be completely safe, where a patient calls a doctor remotely, is approved for medication abortion, and then those pills are dispatched to the patient.
Peter, you reported on an organization in Minnesota called Just the Pill. Isn't that right?
It is called Just the Pill, and it's two women who got together a couple of years ago when they saw the ways that medication abortion could be a safe and private way for people to obtain abortions. And then as they saw states trying to ban or at least severely restrict the delivery of medication for abortions, they had an idea. They said, if you look at the Dakotas, North and South Dakota, where telehealth appointments for medication abortion are banned, what if we could set up shop remotely in Montana and Wyoming, and women could just drive across the border, call us after they pull over in their car, we do the telehealth appointment, and then we can safely send these two pills to a distribution site in Montana and Wyoming, and that's what they're doing.
It sounds like the world that you're portraying, a post-Roe world, is going to be one of thousands of women driving to or making their way to places like Illinois, New York, California, from faraway states. That's one aspect of it. And then you'll have the aspect of drugs being traded in one way or another to have abortions that way.
That's exactly right. They're sometimes called abortion migrants, abortion refugees. People with means, they can fly into Chicago and have an abortion at a clinic, of which there are many.
And what do the people you're talking to expect will happen with people who don't have the means to fly to Chicago or wherever, or who don't have the capacity or the knowledge to get the kinds of drugs that you're talking about?
That's the real fear among folks who are in the reproductive rights community, who are providing abortions, who are helping women to get abortions. And it brings them to tears sometimes when they realize, when they start to contemplate what it will mean if Roe is overturned. So there are abortion funds all over the country. A large one in Chicago is called the Chicago Abortion Fund. And these funds help women navigate an abortion, how to get one, how to get to town, how to pay for it, how to arrange for childcare if they have to be away for a couple of days, and lodging. And the Chicago Abortion Fund has been receiving an average of 500 calls a month this year, 85% of them from out of state.
Peter, what will you be watching for in the months ahead?
Let's imagine for a moment that the Supreme Court overturns Roe, as the Alito draft suggests will happen. It will be valuable to look at legislatures in Republican-led states to see just how far they will go to ban abortions. In some cases, it'll be almost immediate, such as in Missouri, where the Attorney General has said that he will take the measures to invoke a trigger law, stopping abortions as soon as the Supreme Court rules. And then we'll be looking to extremely creative believers in a woman's right to choose who will be looking for ways around these rules and ways to help women get an abortion if they so choose.
Gia Tolentino has reported on the reproductive choice battle and the ways that it goes beyond abortion. Gia, earlier this year, you wrote a piece for The New Yorker about Oklahoma, where in 2012, there was an attempt to amend the state constitution to establish what's known as fetal personhood. And the state Supreme Court there ultimately struck it all down. How does this idea of fetal personhood work its way into law?
A lot of conservative legislatures, state legislatures, have introduced fetal personhood bills.
Like Oklahoma.
Most of them have failed. But so Oklahoma's failed, but then you see Oklahoma as sort of a test case of what might happen, right? So the fetal personhood amendment fails in 2012. But in 2015, the state medical code was amended to require that any fetal death past 12 weeks would be reported as a stillbirth, right? There was something called the Humanity of the Unborn Child Act, passed in 2016, which required that the State Department of Health teach that, quote, abortion kills a living human being, mm-hmm. right? And since then, in Oklahoma, you have had this pretty wild, rampant, extreme prosecution of miscarriage. There was this report by The Frontier that at least 45 women in Oklahoma have been charged with child abuse, child neglect, manslaughter because of drug use during pregnancy.
Gee, when I hear about the prosecution of miscarriage, how can that happen? What is that?
So fetal personhood is the idea that a fetus, starting at conception, the moment of conception, which is to really say an embryo, is a human life that is deserving of full legal protection. It's the idea that underpins the entire anti-abortion movement. It's the idea that's given the movement its urgency, right? The idea that abortion is a human rights violation, that it is a death for a human life that is vulnerable but equal and possibly even superior to yours and mine. Fetal personhood is sort of the only and fundamental idea that would require a total ban on abortion, which is the goal of the anti-abortion movement and the ideal that's now in the minds of many conservative legislators.
And it's why you get people sincerely and for many years saying abortion equals
murder. Right. So miscarriages are incredibly common. There are about 1 million miscarriages in the United States every year. If every miscarriage is grounds for suspicion that something has been done to endanger or even take a human life, whether that thing is using drugs or over-exercising or, you know, or doing any number of the things that women are told they're not supposed to do during pregnancy or else something might happen to, quote unquote, the baby, you know, then miscarriages become, and they will become, grounds for prosecution quite broadly.
You grew up in Texas. You grew up with a lot of people who are quite religious and have kept up with a lot of that. It's not like you're detached from the community in which you were brought up. And when you remember those arguments, those pro-life arguments, and when you engage them now, do you have any sympathy for them?
I do. I do have sympathy for them because I think, you know, the modern pro-life movement was founded in this idea of it was a human rights issue, right? That stopping the right to abortion was saving innocent lives. And I think that kind of rhetoric twists the impulse to protect life in a way that invalidates, you know, the autonomy of the mother and the civic participation of women. But I understand why, if you really believed that life began at conception, you would do anything that you could to protect it. Mm-hmm. I just think that that idea is a lot easier to get behind rhetorically than to actually live with to the letter every second of the day. If people really believed this idea that is being jurisprudentially pushed upon the nation with Roe's repeal, then people would act very differently. That, you know, people still do IVF, which is something that if you really believe life begins at conception and in fetal personhood from conception, then you wouldn't be able to stand IVF because there would be innocent human lives in freezers, right? The idea is so extreme and it's so jurisprudentially unworkable, as we are probably about to see, that it has these far-ranging implications for miscarriage, for the prosecution of miscarriage, for IVF, and everything surrounding it. If you believe in the personhood of an embryo at conception, then things like IUDs and the morning after pill are tantamount to murder. And this is kind of the territory that we're wading into.
Gia, the leaked opinion has set off what feels like an avalanche of nightmare scenarios about where the court goes next as a result of this. Without the privacy right that comes from Roe, there are concerns about gay marriage, access to birth control, even in some circles, coming out of the Loving case, interracial marriage. At this point, how are you differentiating legitimate concerns from panic?
Yeah, I think that reading through the draft opinion, there are plenty of reasons to fear all of those things, right? There are plenty of reasons to fear a world in which, if the Constitution written for a country where only white male landowners are full citizens, if those are the only rooted rights in America, if people feel panicked about all those things, I wouldn't invalidate that. But even just focusing on what will happen when Roe falls and what will happen to mothers and poor mothers and 13-year-olds and trans men and people with ectopic pregnancies and people who come into the hospital miscarrying and then are drug tested and pulled up on, you know, charges of manslaughter, which has happened and will continue to happen. This is enough to panic about. This is a universe of panic on its own.
We'll be right back. The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino, and we heard too from Peter Slevin and Margaret Talbot. You can read all of our coverage on the battle over abortion rights at newyorker.com. And if you missed it, I'd urge you to listen to a piece we aired last week too, a visit to the Mississippi Abortion Clinic at the very center of this critical case before the Supreme Court. You can find it all on the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Peter Hessler has been living on and off in China for 25 years, reporting for the New Yorker and also teaching subjects like English composition at Sichuan University. Some years ago, Peter was attacked online for remarks that a student called treasonous. And he's just written about the experience in an essay called A Teacher in China Learns the Limits of Free Expression. And it asks the question, how has China gone through so much change, social, economic, educational, while its politics have remained so stagnant? Peter Hessler spoke with Evan Osnos on our podcast, Politics and More.
There's always a different side to it. Like, I think a lot of Chinese people look at that. A lot of people I know would say, well, maybe if we had thrown political change into all those things, it would have been too much. Or maybe the political stability allowed us to have the economic change and the social change and the educational improvements. And I think there's logic to both sides, to be honest. I don't think there's an easy answer to this. But it is, you know, I think it's very natural for people looking from the outside to be confused by these cross dynamics.
This week, Peter Hessler is on our podcast, Politics and More. Before the pandemic, Megan Stalter was an unknown comedian doing comedy shows all over the place, trying to get a break in acting and posting an occasional video on Twitter and TikTok. But once the pandemic hit, those videos became her only outlet. Stalter began producing them at a rapid clip, very short character sketches. And with everybody at home, on the internet, way too much, she started to find a big audience, racking up millions of views. On social media, she became known as the Queen of Quarantine.
April 10th, 2 p.m. Central Standard Time. I had just got back from an amazing date. I went to Red Lobster last night, and in between the Chatterbay biscuits, I kissed the waiter. And then I got invited back into the kitchen to kiss all the chefs.
It's shot on her phone, and the props and costumes are whatever she can find around the house. Her characters embody the full spectrum of socially awkward and clueless. And suddenly, Stalter jumped from the internet to television as the worst assistant in the world on HBO's hit show, Hacks.
Okay, Kayla, you're supposed to be on mute.
Oh, I am. I just pushed the thing, bud.
Okay, bud, we can hear you, so you're definitely not.
Oh, don't worry, I'm not listening. I'm laughing at a meme.
You're supposed to be listening. We've talked about this. You listen and you take notes, right?
Yeah. So, okay, where's my notebook? Hey, I need to leave early. I have an adult ballet recital. Like, just, I can't miss this one because I missed last week. It just wouldn't make sense.
Michael Shulman is a staff writer who covers culture for The New Yorker, and he's one of the many new fans of Megan Stalter.
Am I getting it right that Hacks is your first professional acting job proper? Or
yes.
Were you doing other stuff? Yes. You just went from, like, nothing to HBO Max, huge comedy hit.
Yeah, I couldn't be more lucky. I can't believe it. I mean, that's, like, my first time on set. Like, that's the first time I was ever had, like, a professional acting job. And I haven't even done, like, a commercial.
So Hacks, for people who are not caught up on it, it centers on this old-school Vegas headliner comedian named Dipper Vance, played by the amazing, truly amazing Jean Smart, who hires a 20-something comedian named Ava, played by Hannah Einbinder, to kind of punch up her act and be her assistant. You play Kayla, who is an essential part of the show. Can you describe who Kayla is?
Yeah, so Kayla is... So Ava has this manager, and Kayla is the manager's assistant, and she's a bad assistant.
Kayla?
Mm-hmm.
What is in this coffee?
Half and half in sugar. Well, a Splenda.
Okay.
A couple of Splendas.
That's not sugar, it's all chemicals, and I take natural sugar.
Yeah. Brain.
All right.
F-A-R-T.
All right.
is your phone ringing or something?
I don't know. Let's find out.
She's kind of party fashionista, silly, rich girl whose dad owns the company. So she has this privilege and power.
Hi. Hello.
Daddy's at work.
So how's my baby girl doing? Huh?
She's unbelievable. Really special.
You know?
Special.
She kind of sees Jimmy as they're kind of like equals, even though Jimmy is her boss. But I think she sees them as like coworkers, and she kind of lives in her own world and doesn't even realize how privileged she is.
Yeah, she's what the internet would now call a nepo baby.
Yes, and yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Hacks is very much about this generational divide in comedy, with Dipper Vance representing the kind of old school, punchline heavy Joan Rivers school of comedy, and then Ava is the kind of less crowd-pleasing, more jagged, millennial, Gen Z kind of comedy. I'm curious if you see your own work in those terms, if you feel like you're on one side or the other of that divide.
My hope is always that my stuff can be understood by people of all ages. I feel like I draw a lot from the kind of older comedians anyway, like kind of like an a sort of like one woman show in the 80s.
Right.
Like, I don't know, like an older woman doing like a Vegas style like one woman show is kind of like my inspiration. I like performing for people that like, I don't know, I at least like to hope that people of all ages can be on the inside of the joke. I love Hacks because I feel like there's something for everyone in the show. You know, and I think like, I mean, Paul was saying a lot that a lot of times people tell him like, oh, this is like the show I can watch with my mom and like she loves it too. Because I think any sort of, I don't know, comedy is so subjective, but any sort of art that's like not including or alienating a huge group of people is, I just would rather not. I would rather not alienate any age group or like type of person. I feel like Hacks is something that people of all ages and like gender would be into because there's something kind of for everyone in it.
How did you start performing? Was there a kind of spark where you felt, oh, I have to be on that stage?
Yeah, I really never remember not wanting to perform. I can't ever remember a time I wasn't making videos. Like when I was little, we always liked making videos, me and my siblings and my cousins. And anytime there was like a talent show or a Christmas pageant, I'd like be desperate to be in it. And I remember my choir teacher gave me like a solo at
for the Christmas pageant, and I just practiced the song over and over and over again. It was just probably two lines of the solo, but I was so like, oh my God, I just really needed to be on stage. But I do think that I've always been sort of weird, freaky, silly. Mm-hmm. I definitely didn't fit in high school, you know, besides like drama club. And I auditioned for everything, and I would like research the role, and I would get like, you know, prepare a lot. And I never got the parts that I wanted, probably ever. But I did play Helen Keller's mom in The Miracle Worker. And I didn't even get that part. I was an understudy, and then they let me have it because the lead dropped out or something.
Really?
Yeah. But that was probably my shining role. Like, she had lines at least. But after high school, I did think like, I mean, I didn't have any money saved to move to LA or New York. And we don't, you know, we don't come from money. And I just like went to different community college programs. And all I really wanted to do was perform, but I just couldn't even see a way. But then finally, like after trying a bunch of different things, like teaching, nursing, like missions, church work, like I did Bible school. And
you did?
Yeah, I was really involved in my church. And I was like, well, if I can't do what I really want to do, then maybe God wants me to like choose something that's like, you know, like helpful, but a job where I know I can make money after college.
So pre-pandemic, what was your life like? Can you just kind of describe what you were doing, what your state of your career, of your life, where you were living? What was going on?
Yeah, I had just moved to New York like 6 or 7 months before the pandemic. And I was having the time of my life, like on different shows every night. And it was like, I was like, oh, this is the dream. This is the New York dream. And I think that's when I first started getting any sort of traction online. I do remember right before the pandemic, my first couple videos that had ever gone, not viral, but like a lot of people were watching it more than normal for me. And I think one video was, I was playing like, it was like woman in the movie who almost hooks up with the lead before he goes off to find his real true love or something like that. And it was like,
oh, I remember that one.
Tim, we don't have to do this. You're a good guy. And you're in love with somebody. And it's not me. So go get her. I'll be okay. I have blonde hair. I'm fine. Go get her.
And I was like, oh my God. Like, wow, I'm really doing it. I'm in New York and I'm doing these shows at night. And I'm like, people are watching my stuff online. But then I think the real attention came with the pandemic. It really changed everything, and it was not focusing on trying to get people to see it, to be honest. Like, I just was doing these really crazy themed Instagram lives every night because I was so alone, and I was like, this is a fun way to feel, like, connected. Or even, like, posting stuff, I'm like, oh, this is, like, a creative outlet because we can't perform live right now, and it was really scary and sad for me. So I was just trying to stay afloat. I was just trying to, like, not lose my mind. It was just, it was so scary. But then, like, things were happening for me, too, online.
Yeah, yeah. It's this weird combination of, like, a horrible moment for the world, good time right. for Meg's career. I want to look at one of the videos that went really viral during the pandemic. This was from June of 2021. It was a video for Pride Month.
Hi, gay. Happy Pride Month. We are sashaying away with deals. This month at the Butter Shop, we're running a special deal. If you can prove that you're queer, you get 3 pints off your choice of creamed, chucked, or drowned butter. We love gay, and it's awesome.
That video, it was like, I literally was like rushing out the door. It was Pride Month, and I've just seen so many ads just from places that would never normally do, like, a Pride thing. And it just was like, I don't know, something clicked where it was like, God, that would be so funny.
We've been making butter since 1945, and we've been accepting all people since the last 4 months. So, yeah, we're gagging for you to come take a taste of Cecily's Butter Shop at Cecily's Butter Shop. My friend's mom, I think is gay, so we think it's cool.
I mean, it's obviously a great satire of how companies co-opt the language of pride to sell products during June. But to me, it's what's so funny about it is that it's more than that. It's like you see this character who's just so unused to being on camera, just kind of trying and failing to be presentable and pull this off.
So the whole thing, I'm reading off the computer. So all of what I said was written, but I think it was... I normally do like to improv with the videos, but that one I was like, it'd be funny if it looks scripted and like looks like I'm reading off a script. I think what I'm like drawn to when I'm people watching or getting inspired to do like a character is people that are really fully themselves, like out loud. They're different than everyone else, but they are like so themselves that it doesn't matter what other people think of them.
Well, there's something about your characters that they sort of like... represent the breadth of American idiocy. Like there's this one video I love where you play a woman in her car who has just been to Starbucks and is so outraged.
And I'm stopped right in my tracks. And yeah, she goes, yeah, happy Halloween. Happy Halloween. That's what we're saying. And she goes, yeah, happy spooky season. I say, oh, well, the only thing spooky to me is the fact that y'all are celebrating the most wicked holiday. And yet when I come over here and December 11th, when I come over here December 24th for my, you know, Christmas Eve drink, all I get is happy holiday. Happy holidays. Happy holidays. We're neutral. We're neutral. Happy holidays.
And of course, like we all have followed these people who... get outraged about the war on Christmas or whatever. And in a way, online culture has just opened up everyone, has made everyone a kind of on-camera performer. And you do really capture the sense that so many people are performing for the camera nowadays who just kind of aren't up for it. You can see them trying and kind of failing. It's like we're all performers now.
Right, everyone feels this pressure. Everybody wants to be famous or go viral. And it's fun to make fun of and to explore, like, why do people feel that way? Why do people feel the pressure to do that? That's what's so funny about these front-facing video characters, because, like that video a lot of people thought was real. Because, like, and that's
really?
What's so funny. Yeah, like, I think my favorite characters to watch are people that feel real, like, even if they're not like bonkers. They just feel like, oh, well, I know that woman, like that church woman, even though she was saying crazy things about the Starbucks employee and celebrating Halloween, she's so real.
So what kind of things were people saying on Twitter who thought it was real?
People were upset with her, this character, and was, you know, saying like the whole like, you know, wow, like I don't think a Christian should be yelling a barista, or like you're not the real kind of Christian, or like you know, I don't think God would like that. And the other thing is I really like the low quality of the videos, because it almost feels like the person's even more real, because it's like they filmed it themselves. And when the fun thing is like you can prank people, because people don't, if they don't follow you, there's so much of that content now online that yours kind of just, you can put yours up and people think you're serious. And that's really a part of the joke for me.
Megan Stalter spoke with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. You can see her in Hacks and the new series Queer as Folk, a reboot, which premieres in June. You can read Michael Shulman at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Helen Rosner. I'm a staff writer at the New Yorker, and I mostly write about food and cooking and chefs and cookbooks and things like that.
For a foodie like Helen Rosner, heaven is spending the day in the kitchen with another serious cook.
Hi!
Hi, Helen.
Ah, it's so good to see you.
Really good to see you.
Learning new dishes and techniques and talking about their favorite subject, even or especially when the conversation is just not fit for broadcast.
I was asked I don't know how much I could swear here, fuck, marry, kill, pasta, rice, bread.
Oh my God.
I know my answers. I'm very curious about yours.
That's really hard.
It's so hard. Yes.
Okay. I think I fuck pasta.
Fully.
We are fully fucking pasta. Can we just, like, sacrificially kill potatoes and keep both rice and bread?
Look at you going rogue and bringing in potatoes. Like, potatoes coming to me like, wait, I wasn't even a part of this narrative. What is happening here?
Recently, Helen went to visit Andy Baragani at his home in Brookhaven, New York.
I met Andy Baragani a decade ago when we were working at the same food magazine. Even back then, Andy had had a pretty impressive career. He'd cooked at Chez Panisse in high school. That's Alice Waters' famous restaurant in Berkeley, California. But you might know Andy from Bon Appetit's YouTube channel, where he brought his personality, his flair, to every video and dish that he made. Growing up the gay Iranian-American kid in California who watched Jacques Pepin and Julia Child and Martin Yan on TV, Andy had no idea where his blossoming love of food would take him. He's recently published his first cookbook. It's called The Cook You Want to Be, and it's explosive, but maybe not in the way you'd think. Andy fills the pages with tiny changes, little tricks, tiny adjustments, small lessons that transform your cooking from everyday home cooking to really restaurant-level dazzle. It's like adding lemon zest to your breadcrumbs, which gives them acidic and floral notes that totally changes the game. When you watch Andy cook, you also kind of want a pencil and pad right next to you so you can jot down little notes about every little thing he does. So where did this book begin for you? When did you start writing this? Because you've been cooking professionally for like 20 years or 15 years.
But... 15 years, yeah. The book was actually had a different name for a moment. It was The Cook I Want to Be.
Ah.
And the book was going to be even that much more personal, kind of taking on, telling all the stories throughout my life. And while there are definitely still, you know, personal essays, I changed the I to you. I wanted to bring in the reader. I wanted to extend a hand. And I didn't want it to just be about what I've gone through. I wanted to kind of pass those stories and those lessons to the reader so that to empower them and so that hopefully they could find out the cook they want to be.
I love the way that you approach sauces in this cookbook. I'd love to talk to you about that a little bit too.
Yes.
You open one of the first sections in the book is just a collection of all-purpose sauces, and they're not what I would expect to see in a collection of all-purpose sauces, where like you might expect to see, well, like here's your marinara and here's your pesto, but instead you open with like this shocking lemon and shallot vinaigrette, and you don't even suggest putting it on a salad. You suggest using it on top of grilled vegetables or roasted meats.
Yes, I think it's really when you have a pantry full of great sauces or toppings or sprinkles, it elevates the dish. You don't need to do much to the dish. You can roast some vegetables, and if you have a good sauce, it kind of ties it all together. There's a section for tangy things, which is called a hit of acid, creamy sauces, green sauces, crunchy toppings, fiery sauces that are to add some heat. I think it's always helps to have a few sauces in your back pocket.
Are there any lessons or tricks or recipes or ingredient pairings in the book that were revelations to you, that you learned from someone or that you discovered and that just sort of made your eyebrows shoot up and you went, oh my God, this is it?
Oh my God, now my Rolodex is going through. I rarely want to roast pistachios because it dries them out or removes their freshness, and I want that tender, creamy inside, so I leave them raw. Or I take my panko breadcrumbs, which you'll see later today, to the point where they're just almost burnt, but I don't burn them because I want that deep, toasty nuttiness from them. Cook your seeds and nuts in fat, so you have this beautifully toasted nut, but then that scented leftover fat as well. I don't even know. To always save your pasta water. There's so many things. There are too many things.
So now that you've gotten to know Andy a little bit, let's cook. What are we making today?
So today we're making this cauliflower ragu with lemony breadcrumbs. And it doesn't have a lot of ingredients, but it has a lot of flavor. And it kind of mimics the texture and flavor of a bolognese, but without the meat.
So we're here in the kitchen. And on this electric stove, you have two big pots. One is slightly taller and more narrow, and one is slightly wider and shorter. What are these two big pots for?
I have two pots set up, which I am a firm believer in for pasta. If you're cooking for four people and you're cooking anything more than 12 ounces of pasta, you have to have a two-pot setup. What that means is you have a pot of boiling water for your pasta and then a pot for your sauce, and where your pasta will eventually end up and finish.
Not a skillet, but a pot.
No, even a very large skillet or a large skillet with the high sides, it still, to me, doesn't do the trick because there's too much going on and the pasta will get messy, the sauce will go all over. You want a large pot. I'm telling you, it is a game changer, I promise. So we're just heating some oil up in the same pot where you're going to make the sauce. Heat that up over medium-high heat. You'll be adjusting the heat if it goes too hot. And then you're adding half a cup of panko, Japanese breadcrumbs. And you're just going to let that sizzle and toast, and you'll see how it'll gradually change from this kind of pale, just almost off-white color to golden, to then this like deeply, deeply toasty, crunchy breadcrumb.
Oh, that it happened. They totally just right? crossed the line.
See?
They meaningfully got darker.
Right there. It's like takes it, and people really would pull like 20 seconds before, but this is, I think, where it makes all the difference.
So, dicing the cauliflower.
Yes. So, you're taking a whole head of cauliflower, and if you have a food processor, you could just remove the florets and throw in the stems and just pulse it until you kind of get these kind of bitsy pieces. They don't need to be even. You want that kind of irregularity here.
And it's bigger than cauliflower rice. It's not like teeny tiny little grains.
Definitely.
They're like chunks.
Yes.
Small chunks.
Small chunks. And then you'll set that aside. A little bit of prep work, slicing the onions, slice one red onion, and then quite a bit of garlic.
Sauce pot.
Sauce pot, you're just heating up more oil up. And then once that's hot, I add the thinly sliced onion and garlic.
You take the onions in this step a lot farther than I feel like I'm used to taking my onions when I'm making a pasta sauce. Like, really, like they're browning on the edges. And
we don't want these onions to be blonde and juicy and soft or jammy. We want them frizzled and brown in spots and that kind of caramelization. And then anchovies, which, you know, you can omit. You don't have to put it in, but
I think we should even give people that option.
Okay, I take that back. You have to use them. I'm sorry, everybody.
They add so much. They're essential.
It fools the people who are tasting it that are not the cook that it's been cooking for a long, long time. And then I add half a cup of tomato paste.
It really does get incredibly dry in the pan when you just have this deep, dark, brick red onion, garlic, tomato jam.
And I'll say, like, you'll be very tempted to add more oil because the pot will look dry, and you'll see how the tomato paste is beginning to stain some of the oil, but don't. That's when you kind of add the cauliflower. And then you're gonna add your pasta that to the pot that has not cooked all the way. It'll be a little bit too crunchy, but you'll add that pasta and a good amount of pasta water. I always save my pasta water, but I'll start with a cup and a half, which is a lot. But because your sauce is not really a loose sauce, it's a paste. So you add your pasta, water. They're not two separate things. It's not pasta and sauce. They need to marry and come together. And this is where it's essential to kind of take the time. It's gradual. And then we throw in the butter to kind of add that another layer of fat.
Oh, wow.
And that takes it to really another level because the sauce has so many things going on, even with the few ingredients. It's garlicky, it's oniony, it has all that anchovy flavor, it's spicy, it's tangy from the tomato, and the butter kind of soothes everything and allows really all those ingredients to kind of shine and come through and stop fighting one another. And then you just plate it up in bowls, and you have that toasty lemony breadcrumbs, and I am a big fan of carbs on top of carbs.
I love it. So how do you feel about people who add red pepper flakes as a finishing spice?
I don't understand it.
I don't know.
I'm very confused because most red pepper flakes are just have no heat to them. They need to kind of come back to life. I feel like they've been living in the aisles, depressed, sad, and just they need to be awakened. And they need that heat and that fat to kind of come alive. And if you just sprinkle on it, it tends to be too coarse. So if you're sprinkling it to finish, I would grind it up at least. Not with your fingers, but really get in there with a mortar and pestle or a spice.
Andy Baragani is the author of The Cook You Want to Be, and he spoke with The New Yorker's Helen Rosner. And that's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. If you're making the cauliflower ragu, don't burn the breadcrumbs, and let us know how it goes. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.